Let's join Maggie Linton on SiriusXM Urban View, Channel 110.
Well, welcome back. We continue our discussion about overcoming drug addiction and family with love. It's Scott Husha and Libra Riley. I'm going to pick it up going back to New York, and we're going to start talking to Libra and Husha. Husha, let's begin with you and your dad and what you saw and what you experienced.
I remember meeting my father for the first time because my mom had to put him out when we were like 1.5 years old, which was sad because she really was deeply in love with him. It was just the drugs. But so we had no memory of living with him. So when we met him for the first time, I say when we were 12 years old, I remember looking at him for the first time thinking, oh my goodness, I look just like him. He was handsome,
yes,
charming, intelligent. At 12, I can see this. And just in awe that I'm standing there next to my real dad. And because we had already had a relationship with his parents for many years, but no one ever talked about him. And my sister and I got used to no one ever talks about dad, but we see an army picture on their one of their coffee tables. So we got used to never asking questions about where's our father. So when we finally met him, it was just, we couldn't believe it was happening. It was really surreal. And we thought this was going to be happily ever after. And it really wasn't that. Very soon thereafter, it wasn't. So it was really just hard to, as a child, realize that this isn't going to be the happily ever after.
Yeah, this is not the life of Riley.
It's not.
Exactly. Libra, what were you going to say?
Well, just that when I go back to the book, the first chapter where you hear our voices is in the reunion. And Husha wrote that chapter. We found that in the writing of this book, you know, it's funny when you're twins. My sister and I are very close, so quite often one voice can very easily represent the two of us. We're two grown women and very independent. But when we wrote this, going back to childhood, we realized that we shared so many of the same feelings. Mm-hmm. So when she wrote the reunion and I read it, we both said, this is very easily our story. Mm-hmm. And we do remember that. It was the first time we had met our little sister. We didn't even know we had one. And I will tell you, it was a strange moment because we're 12-year-olds and we're thinking that our dad has been somewhere just pitiful, missing us, longing for us, that life couldn't go on until he met these girls. Yeah. Where are my daughters? And when he walked in, he was gorgeous. He was intelligent. He was tall, dark, handsome, beautiful, all those things that he looked like in this picture that we had been looking at for 12 years. But when we met our little sister, her name is Maya, we just thought, oh, you have gone on with life. Mm-hmm. You have a new wife. You have a daughter. You haven't been somewhere missing us. This is 12-year-old girls. Mm-hmm. You would like to think that someone has missed you so much they couldn't breathe. And we thought, he looks like he's been breathing.
You look like, and here's proof that he's been doing more than breathing.
Right. We've been doing some things here. And then Maya, you know, Maya's mother is Puerto Rican. And so Maya, she just looked like a little Indian princess to us. And so there was that 12-year-old jealousy of, we just look like ordinary black girls. She looks special. She looks different. But then what broke that, and again, God's grace is so good, because what broke that was she loved us the moment she saw us. The moment she saw us, you would think an only child might be feeling like my daddy. Mm. This girl was like my sisters, my sisters.
Wanted to hold our hands the whole
night.
Wouldn't
let us go. And so again, you know, grace in the wilderness piece, as we look back on it, we realize that God has been with us every step of the way. Mm-hmm. Even in that 12-year-old moment of we feel jealousy, that child running up to us with my sisters, would not let go of our hand, cried when she thought they were leaving, made it clear to two 12-year-olds that we're good. Mm-hmm. We have been missed. This girl has never met us and acts like she could never live without us after today. So this book has also been a grace in the wilderness for us in that, and we'll get to this later, but that same 12-year-old girl who is a 37-year-old woman now had been estranged from us for the last couple of years due to some other issues. This book brought us back together again. Mm-hmm. So again, there's just so many ties back to the grace piece in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. But yeah, meeting Dad at 12, it was beautiful and it was hard. Because, you know, I will tell you something. There was something in the minds of two 12-year-olds, and the beauty of being twins is you have each other to process things.
So discussion.
A lot of processing.
There's a lot of talking
too
going
on. Too much processing, actually.
Exactly. You know, where mom is saying, girls, good night, we're up talking, you know,
because the lights out.
We got to talk about this. Mm-hmm. We saw dad. What did you think? Well, what did you think? And what did you see? It was beautiful, but at the same time, I do think we had an awareness that this might not go on very long. Mm-hmm. It was just, it's a strange thing that children have a sense about things that adults, because I'm somebody's mother now, children do have a sense about things not being right. We couldn't put it all together. We were sheltered. Our grandparents never said a bad word. Our mother, but just something didn't
seem right.
And the story, the book begins to unfold to give you an idea of the state of mind of two girls who became women. And so the next chapter is visiting dad, where, again, a little more unraveling of, okay, here's the reunion. We're going to set up these visits. And God bless my mom, because I think she knew this was going to be shaky, but I also think she knew the girls need to experience a little bit of this, just a little bit at a time, and then Scott will reveal to them what they need to know. And it will happen in the when it needs to happen in terms of their ability to process the information. And that is how it happened, because visiting dad, slowly but surely, we're processing, going back over the George Washington Bridge to go back to the suburbs of Jersey. And, you know, within a year, we're looking at each other like, thank God.
Yeah, something's not right.
We knew.
We didn't feel safe. We didn't want to tell mom because she wouldn't let us go back.
Yeah. Well, let me explain this.
Because, Ben, because I was going to come to you next. I'm going to give you your chance.
They're coming from, they were born in Harlem. Mm-hmm. And eventually their mom and their stepfather bought a place, pardon me, in
Teaneck,
you know.
In Jersey.
So for all intents and purposes, they went back to the same kind of suburban living that I grew up in, you know. In the meantime, I, of course, had moved out of Harlem and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And I was living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where anything goes, you know what I'm saying? So
and you were going with it, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
So they would come over and they would see this alternate lifestyle, the kind of structural lifestyle that they were used to, going to bed at a certain time, eating dinner at a certain time or whatever. My youngest daughter, Maya, kind of ate whenever she was hungry, went to bed when she felt like going to bed, got up basically in anything other than a school day when she felt like getting up. There were people coming in and out of my household, because I was, of course, dealing, that considered themselves to be her uncles or aunts or whatever, that if their actual criminal records and such were looked at, these were, quote-unquote, some fairly bad people by society standards.
Subversive.
Absolutely. how they treated my daughter then and whenever they probably see her now was sterling, you know. There is honor, at least in those days, among thieves.
Mm-hmm.
But so the holes in the story came as they became aware of there is something going on that we're not quite seeing in front, because I wasn't doing these things in front of their face, but they knew something was going on.
Yeah. Yeah. There was too many people visiting.
I was awfully popular. You know?
It was one little transaction that we saw, and we were like, what is that in that bag there? Is that powder? Why would he be having baby powder in that bag? Because we're 12. So we knew then that there was something going on.
But no clue what it was.
But no clue.
Well, the drug culture wasn't as open then as it is now. It was among certain, you know, factions, but generally it was not, you know. Once again, we're talking with Scott, Hasha, and Libra Riley, and we're talking about their book, Grace in the Wilderness, A Family Story of Love, Loss, and Redemption. And by the way, folks, if you want to jump in, you're certainly welcome to join in the discussion. It is 866-801-8255. Once again, 866-801-8255. Let's talk about what happened to you that made you finally decide you didn't want to do the drugs anymore.
Oh, this was a long, long process.
Yeah, because you were under the influence for 30 years.
Right. You drowned in this thing. Mm-hmm. And the mythology of drug use and drug abuse is that once in, you can't get out. I'm 68 years old. I was pre-methadone. I was before methadone programs and things like this. The only way, as you and I were just talking, was to go to Leavenworth. You know, that was kind of like the way to get clean, and that was a whole process in itself. So, like, you didn't want to do that. And because people were kicking cold turkey. And my drug of choice, of course, was heroin, you know. So I saw no way in. So finally, when methadone came along, I gave that a try. But once again, I had this creepy crawly dragging one foot behind me. So although I was on a program and taking my prescribed dosage of methadone, I was still getting high every day. And by then, the getting high thing was the mixture of cocaine and heroin, which is called a speedball. My method of delivery was injection. So I was had turned myself literally into a human pincushion. And as I say in one of the chapters of the book, the copying the drug, getting the money was horrible, bad enough, and copying the drugs was a pain in the neck. But all of that paled in comparison to actually finding a site to actually use this stuff. So that's kind of like, so what happened was I was, boy, I'm telling you, you know, we are blessed in life. We don't realize it. There are angels and people standing around us all the time giving us great information. And most of the time, I know in my own case, I blow by them and don't hear it.
That's because you weren't ready to listen.
This is quite true. Mm-hmm. I had gone for, this was 1995. By now, I've left the second family, actually the third family, so three failed marriages, kids that, you know, I'm not seeing and have a shoddy relationship with or whatever, and I'm living on the streets, homeless in New York City, and it is wintertime. I'm sleeping in the snow. Now, it didn't occur to me that, you know what, you're a middle-class kid from a great family. You don't really have to do this, you know, prodigal son, a la prodigal son. But no, I was so ashamed, of course, of what I had become and had formed this whole new relationship with a whole new group of thieves and criminals or whatever. So that's what I was doing. I had gone to my methadone program for my yearly checkup, and the PA on the program said, "What happened to you? What have you done to yourself?" And I had no explanation. He said, "Well, listen, if you will go to this place, Tsukasa, which is part of Lower East Side Service Center, I work there at night in doing intake there and screening intakes for them. I'll walk your paperwork over from here to there." And I'm like, well, gee, that's easy. So, okay, so I went and I showed up. And so I, of course, I was going to take this short-term part of the program where they keep you still on your methadone dose, but you're not using secondary drugs anymore. And after 6 months, you're out of there and you've moved on. But I came to believe. And when we come to believe, it is the, okay, it is the grace in the wilderness moment. Yes, I got to give them a prompt. But yeah, I actually came to believe. Now, while I was in the short stay portion of the program, I began to once again reach out to my folks and write them.
The letter writing
then
began.
Then I got this heart-rending letter from my daughter. And at the end of the letter, which just takes your breath away. She tells me at the end of this letter, I'm going to give you, you know, my work number.
The 1-800 number.
The 1-800, but I'm not going to give you my home number or my address because if you didn't call me, I would be hurt. And she knew me by then. So
promises not kept.
Absolutely.
Right. And of course, there was a punitive thing going on in the program, which they called a closed house. There was a lot of stuff going on, so they closed the house down. So for the next 30 days, I walked around with this letter in my pocket, and I couldn't respond to her because we could not write letters or call or whatever. So when I, do I have time to tell this?
Yes, of course.
Okay. So,
that's the reason why I gave you an hour.
So not too long after that, there was going to be at City College, Ileana Van Zandt was coming up there for an inspirational chat. And so, you know, they took us all, you know, and I've got on like kind of like old clothes or whatever. I didn't come into treatment with any kind of anything to wear or whatever. And we go there, and there is a sea, a literal sea of black, gorgeous black women sitting out there waiting to hear. And, you know, for some reason, you know, God has jokes. We had to walk all the way down to the front of the stage, across, and all the way back to get to our seats. There was no way to get any other way. And they had warned us before we left the house, don't talk to anybody, don't have anything to say, stay with the group, blah, 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 you know. And this woman stands up in the middle of this crowd because the show had not started yet. And she turns around and she says, Scott Riley. And all of the sea of black women turn around and look. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's my who is that, Scott? So that's my ex-wife, Barbara. And Barbara's making her way out of the seating and coming up. You know, so, you know, so there's the, well, what does she want? And Barbara
she
says,
wants
come
him.
On, come on.
Mom, you
need to come downstairs and call your daughters right now. Mm-hmm. Now, we had the in the chapter, the straw that broke the camel's back, something that I was supposed to help Hasha with because Hasha was trying to move out of Lee. They had an apartment together here in D.C. when they were going to Howard, and they were trying to split up so because Libra had now
had a
boy, had a baby and
got
a husband,
married,
you know,
yeah.
So right. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'll help you, Hasha. And, of course, all of the promises that we make when we are never able to keep them. I had the money when I told her I would do it, but by the time I finally got to the Western Union to send it, I had spent some of it. And once you spend some, you spend the rest.
Oh, yep.
So, okay. So now Barbara is saying, come on downstairs so you can. And I want to call these girls because I know I'm still on the outs with them. Mm-hmm. So we go downstairs and. Oh, they tell me that the counselors tell me, well, go with her and bring back a couple of programs and stuff. So I thought, geez, you know. So I go downstairs and Barbara calls and says, "Girls, there's someone I want you to talk to." Now,
had no idea.
I don't know how to address my own daughters. Mm-hmm. Am I dead? I'm not dead. I'm acting like a dad. Plus. In my mind, they have a dad. They have a stepfather that loves them and cares for them. So who am I? So I said, "It's me. It's Scott." You know, and I hear Hasha say to her boyfriend, which I didn't realize at the time. She says, "It's my dad.
My real dad."
Oh my God! You know, sometimes when somebody says something like that to you. It kind of like puts you in a place where you have to live up to now what has happened.
She called you out, didn't she?
Right, she called me out.
Yeah.
You know? So I can no longer hide behind this. Well, you know, because as long as we call ourselves drug fiends and dope addicts and ex-cons and all the rest of that stuff, that's exactly who we'll be. Mm-hmm. We're none of that. We're children of God and we need to act like it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got permission to begin this journey. And I'm sure that she will tell you the creeping conundrum that they had because they kind of got used to the idea that, hey, he's stabilized now and he's doing the right thing. Maybe he should just leave things alone and not try to go upstairs to the upper part of the program, which took you all the way to abstinence and being drug-free. So,
and I think that happens with a lot of families. There's a little bit of fear of, well, you know, the comfort and chaos.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't good, but we know it. You know what you got, but you don't know what you're going to get, right? So I think families deal with that. Like, when he's clean, who will he be? When he's
no one's ever known him clean.
Right. Well. So we were a little nervous, but, you know, we all stepped into that portal and went on the journey with him. And, you know, we came out on the other side. And that's why we let this book go. We released it as painful as it was because we said, if we can save another family, tell the truth, get the help. Get your life back. Mm. It will be worth it.
And it's never too late as long as you're above ground and breathing.
Absolutely. It is never too late.
We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to hear more from the ladies. So stay tuned. The daughters.
Procrastination had me down. Look what I have found. I find strength, courage, and wisdom. It's been inside of me.
listening to The Maggie Linton Show on Sirius XM Urban View. We'll be right back.